lights off.
Yes, please. Okay, we're ready to go.
I was born in California. I remember people talking about it.
Thank you very much. What I promised is I would return.
No. Oh, it was bad. I lost a boy in that.
We are very happy today to have John Horgan from Watertown, Mass. And he is going to show us film on
Please.
The storm of 1938, which I well remember, was the first hurricane in our area. And then I believe that you also have Storm 78.
I studied that, but today we're not going to do it. I'd keep you here till dawn tomorrow morning. We don't want that. I'm known as the great bloviator, so we want to keep me concentrated.
Okay. It's on yours, John.
Thank you very much. Well, it's a pleasure to be here in the wonderful town of Hingham, Mass., speaking here for the Hingham Low Vision Group. When I give the talk of the hurricane of 1938, I always look around to see if my audience, to see if any members were around then, and unfortunately, you're way too young. Well, I want to just, I'm going to play some music at the conclusion of today's talk. Ella Fitzgerald, Begin. And Benny Goodman. So the Great Hurricane of 1938, can everybody see this? And can you hear me okay?
Okay.
Don't worry about the graphics on the screen. I'll drive the narration. Trust me, they'll be able to hear me in Weymouth. Okay? So, and I'm going to ask if we could hold questions until the end. My name's John Horgan. I'm a New England folklorist. And basically that means I don't have any prefix or suffix that follows my name, and nor do I have $100,000 in student loans following me as well. Sometimes academe is the strong arm of ignorance, and I'll stop there. So I'm a historical weather researcher. I study old storms, basically from anywhere from 1620, when the Pilgrims were dropped off by Columbus at Plymouth Rock. That's what I was told last week by a student. To 1938. I also love historical astronomy, historical fires, earthquake, and I summered in Green Harbor, Mass., so I am a poor colonial boy of the South Shore, and I'm also a professional sports announcer, so if I break out into a honky voice, that's because I work with the Boston Bruins alumni. Cell phones off, please, and usually when I say that, mine rings, but mine is off. We have an emergency exit right out here in case of an emergency. My expert rule, and this applies certainly for this, usually there's someone in the room who knows more about the subject than I do. That's most of our audience here today. And someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. I'm sorry about that, but if you could just... That's great. Thank you. It's just courtesy. We're going to look at the snapshot of the hurricane in 1938. And we're going to ask, what is a hurricane? We're going to look at a history of North Atlantic hurricanes. We'll take a look at the Great Colonial Hurricane and the Great September Gale of 1815, the track of the hurricane, the summer of 38, the muffed forecast, a record low air pressure, New York City, we're going to track the hurricane. It cuts across New York City, Long Island, the flight of the Burghards. Wait till you hear this story. Bucktooth heroes, okay? Connecticut, Kate's House, the Battle of Colt's Dyke. The Great New London Fire, I'm not going to go into that today because I'm going to do something special here today. I'm going to put a new wrinkle into this talk. We're going to get on board a harrowing train ride, a train called the Bostonian, and I'm going to read something from a book here, and I've never done that before, so it's something new for this group that I wanted to put in. Then we're going to go to Rhode Island and look at the flattening of Rhode Island. 40 miles wide, 50 miles long, and this just got scoured. Wedding splashers, that's a play on the term wedding crashers, and then we'll look at the death of the monster. So in this hurricane, we see acts of bravery and cowardice, acts of kindness and selfishness. We see providence, luck, and cruel fate. And up until that time, this is the most costly disaster in the history of the United States. It's known as a lateral buzzsaw. Nobody was prepared because nobody was warned. There are unlikely heroes, and by the time it died out on September 28, 1938, 10 states and 2 countries were affected. You hear about Category 1, Category 2, Category 3. I'm not going to bog you down with math, but this was a Category 3 storm that hit. Basically, the winds were between 111 and 130 miles per hour. I think it was beyond a Category 3 in retrospect. I think it was nearing a Category 4. That's my personal opinion. Storm surge. The only time that I've witnessed storm surge directly was Hurricane Bob in August of 1991. And storm surge is a dome of water 40 to 60 miles long that moves onto the shoreline near the landfall point of the eye of the hurricane. A cubic yard of seawater weighs approximately 1,700 pounds. And basically, storm surge is responsible for nearly 90% of all hurricane-related deaths and injuries. 200,000 died in India in 1876 due to storm surge from a typhoon, and 300,000 in China in 1881. So storm surge does the most damage, followed by wind damage, and then rainfall and flooding. And we're on a vulnerable area on the Atlantic coast. Our population is the most densest, one of the most densest areas in the world. The corridor from New York City to Boston, which is the northeast coast, we're susceptible to hurricanes. We haven't been hit with a hurricane in over 70 years, but there's a lot of people that have built up on the coast. A basic track of hurricanes, they move off of West Africa, move to the northwest, and then some of them either continue on a northwest pattern or sweep to the northeast. And one of the great things is to look at the intensity of New England hurricane strikes of antiquity. I've coordinated with a geologist who's done an analysis of sedimentary deposits, and that reveals major hurricane strikes have struck the New England coast to the intensity of the hurricane of 1938. We know that a hurricane hit New England between 1100 and 1150, between medieval times of 1300 and 1400, between Renaissance times of 1400 and 1450. We also know 1635, 1815, and I've added a new one. It's called Saxby's Gale of 1869. I think that this was also a severe Category 3 or above hurricane that hit New England and should be included in the top three. The Great Colonial Hurricane hit on August 16th, 1635. That's the old-style calendar. And Governor John Winthrop at the time, who came over with the Pilgrims, said, and I quote, "It blew with such violence, with abundance of rain, that it blew down many hundreds of trees, overthrew some houses, and drove ships from their anchors. The tide rose at Narragansett 14 feet higher than ordinary and drowned 8 Indians flying from their wigwams. The ship, passenger ship Angel Gabriel, was destroyed and 21 people were lost. We know that the eye passed to the south and east of Boston. And William Bradford in Plymouth says, it caused the sea to swell to the south wind of this place above 20 feet right up and down and made many of the Indians climb into trees for their safety. It continued about 5 or 6 hours, but the violence began to abate. It blew down many hundreds of thousands of trees. The signs and marks of it will remain this 100 years in these parts." And then after that, he brings in some astronomy. He says, the moon suffered a great eclipse the second night after it. So that's the first major hurricane in Anglo-Saxon history that's recorded in New England. The next is the Great September Gale of 1815. It took place on Saturday, September 23rd, 1815, which is eerily close to the date of September 21st of the Great Hurricane. Noah Webster, quote, "The storm was a proper hurricane." He was a scientist in the area. "One of the several severe storms that struck the North Atlantic shipping lanes that season." If I look at periods of bad weather in New England's history, I have to hearken back to the years 1815 to 1817. 1815 was a severe hurricane season. Late in 1815, a volcano went off in the Philippines, causing the year without a summer in 1816, where it snowed on Boston Common on June 7th of that year, where there was frost in August. And then 1817, because of this volcanic ash in the upper atmosphere, you had some bizarre snowstorms that had bizarre lightning or thunder snow that happened throughout New England. This hurricane, the Great September Gale of 1815, struck Long Island near Center Moriches, which is ironic because that's where the hurricane of 38 also hit. Montauk Point Lighthouse was heavily damaged. In East River, wharves were underwater by 3 feet. The eye passed to the east of Hartford and Springfield. So the Great Colonial Hurricane, the Great September Gale of 1815, and the Great Hurricane of 38, they all go right up the chute, up the Connecticut River Valley. And if you're east of the eye, you're in trouble. The Hampshire Gazette called this particular storm a tornado of wind and rain. Yale received 6.5 inches of rain over 2 days. The New Haven Register said that it drifted several hogsheads of rum and molasses from the wharf. Eastern Connecticut, all of Rhode Island, and east central Massachusetts were raked. The rain had a salty flavor to it. Houses and trees had a white hue from an ocean froth, and it whipped 90-foot sprays from the Charles River. In fact, I have an eyewitness account of what's known as a water spout, which is a tornado on water that was seen in Charles River. So if you look at the major 20th century hurricanes, you have GH-38, you have the Atlantic hurricane of 1944, and then you have Donna and Carol in the 1950s. So this particular hurricane is known as an extratropical cyclone. An extratropical cyclone is a hurricane that, as the eye wall, the center of the hurricane where it's most intense, the storm, as that diminishes and collapses, the duration of the storm is prolonged. In other words, the storm slows down and hangs over an area. And that's what happened to New England, is as the eye wall collapsed, it hung over the area and continued in causing and inflicting all sorts of damage. The strange thing about this is it was first detected at 8:30 a.m. on September 18th to the southeast, or I'll call it the east-southeast, of the Bahamas. A day later, on September 19th, and it moved to the northwest by about 130 miles. It was moving slowly. The following day, on September 20th at 8:30 a.m., it began to race northward. It had moved to the northeast of the Bahamas. And then, I'm sure that you can't see this graphic, but I want to tell you, this thing got, as we say in the West, giddy up. It moved over 60 miles per hour. By 8:30 a.m. on September 21st, it's off the coast of Cape Hatteras. By 5:30 p.m., it's striking New York that same day. So this thing moved quickly, and there was no time to react to it. Just tracking some of the winds, it was a Category 1 on September 13th with 74-mile-per-hour winds. On September 16th, the winds touched 100 miles per hour as a Cat 2. It became a Category 3 on September 17th with 115-mile-per-hour winds. A Category 4 on the 17th of September with 132-mile-per-hour winds. And then a deadly Category 5 just due east of the Bahamas on September 19th, 160 miles per hour of the winds. And as it sat off the coast of Florida, it was a Cat 4 on the 20th. It moved northward on the 21st. It was 127-mile-per-hour winds, but we're going to see some astonishing peak winds in just a moment. So some factoids about the GH-38. It's the most costly disaster in American history up to that year. It moved rapidly up the coast at 67 miles per hour. It traveled 700 miles in 12 hours. So tell me, friends, how can you react to that when it's moving that quickly? Not only is storm moving that quickly, but you've got some bumbling fools in the weather service who don't even give you the accurate forecast. Landfall winds at 127 miles per hour, sustained at 121 miles per hour. Top winds at 156 miles per hour, although at the Blue Hills up the street in Milton, 186 mile per hour gusts. 40-foot storm surges in some places. It hit at high tide, and the seas rose 17 feet in places. Salt water sprayed houses in Montpelier, Vermont. I'm going to say that again. Salt water sprayed houses in Montpelier, Vermont, which is 120 miles to the interior of the ocean. Southern New England coastal areas were inundated. Most victims drowned. Some had their clothes blown completely off. The first impact of the storm surge registered on seismographs in Alaska. And seawater destroyed vegetation 20 miles inland. New England and New York were devastated by this hurricane. Let's go back to that summer of 38. Maybe some of you remember it. There was record precipitation in June and July, a muggy August, and a really muggy September. And then the rains came from September 12th and September 15th, 1 inch of rain each day. The rivers were rising between September 17th and September 20th, constant rain. And September 20th, was the heaviest rainfall. So these are even before the rain bands that came in with the hurricane. So you've got very weak soil, and trees and wooden structures that don't have a solid foundation are prone to fall. They're set up for the storm. 13 inches of rain in 5 days in the Thames River Basin in Connecticut. The hurricane's impact is exacerbated because of that. What's going on that day? Wednesday, September 21st, 1938. Well, that noodle Chamberlain in England is surrendering Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia, to Hitler. The Red Sox beat the St. Louis Browns 8-4, but remain 11 games back in the American League. The forecast, according to the Lowell Sun, is, the weatherman says, more rain and cooler tonight and Thursday. Wrong. And ironically, an editorial appears in the old gray lady, the New York Times, on September 21st, 1938. It says, every year an average of three such whirlwinds, they're talking about hurricanes here, sweep the tropical North Atlantic between June and November. In 1933, there was an all-time record of 20. If New York and the rest of the world have been so well informed about the cyclone, it is because of an admirably organized meteorological service. Wrong. They had no tools, I'll give them that, okay? And here it is, I don't know if you're internet savvy, but I can go out and mow the lawn after my wife nags me a few times, but I can actually determine up to about 5 minutes when it's going to rain due to radar. With satellites. Now, it's Washington, D.C. We're in the National Weather Bureau. A 28-year-old rookie forecaster named Charlie Pierce is filling in for two vacationing meteorologists. He's been tracking the storm that I told you about in the Caribbean, and he's following it intentively. He argues that the storm would be sandwiched between two high-pressure systems and head directly north through New England. It's going to be squeezed between two highs and fed right up the bowling alley and head north. Longtime veteran forecaster Charles Mitchell says, no hurricane has hit New Jersey during my tenure. The current storm is weakening. This will not be a hurricane. A barometric nosedive. Incredible barometric pressure readings. The RMS Carinthia is sailing in the Atlantic and has the lowest reading ever in the history of the North Atlantic, a 27.85 reading. And it's off the coast of Virginia early in the morning of September 21st, 1938. The Red Star's Koenigstein, and I'm going to talk about this in a moment, measures a 28.40 barometric reading and 100 mile per hour winds when it's 40 miles off Block Island. On September 21st, a man on West Hampton Beach in New York thought that his new barometer was broken when it measured 28. While he was at the post office sending it back, his house was blown away. On Fire Island, within 2 hours, they went from a low reading of 29.78 to an inconceivable low of 27.43 on the 21st of September. Back to that red line, Red Star liner, the Koenigstein. The skipper is Alfred Leidig, an old sea salt. He has a barometric reading of 28.40 with 100 mile per hour winds. On board that ship is who we call the father of typhoons. It's September 19th, and Reverend Ernest Gerzi, an Italian Jesuit with 23 years of meteorological experience, while on the Italian liner Conte di Savoia, is bound for New York, and he states that one of my children will be around in about 3 days after checking the weather charts and the barometric readings and sky conditions. He was right. It hits New York City. An average gale starts up at about 65 miles per hour, which is the wind reading of a tropical storm. They get 4.5 inches of rain. The city is at a standstill from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock. Thousands are marooned in office buildings. There is extensive flooding of streets and basements. At 8:45, a power failure at Consolidated Edison left all of the Bronx and parts of Manhattan in darkness. The only death was a hitchhiker who abandoned the stall car that he was riding in. The guy gave a ride. He says, I'm gonna get out. And he was swept away from the current as soon as he got out of the car. On Fort Schuyler Road in Throgs Neck, they had 9-foot waters by 7:30. I mentioned heroes and cowards, our first hero. J. Gilbert Fitting, 40 years old, and Billy McGrath, 30 years old. During the evacuation of Fort Schuyler Road, Fitting slips while pushing an elderly woman in a boat. McGrath goes after him. Both drown. McGrath posthumously awarded the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission's Bronze Medal. And this was also known as the Long Island Express. The southern coast of Long Island is wide open to the Atlantic, whatever the Atlantic may bring it. Long Island was devastated. Here's the selfishness motif now. Some wealthy homeowners forced their servants to remain in their mansions and their cottages while they evacuated, sealing their fate. One account has a family and friends packed into their car, driving off with their servants, watching in ankle-deep rising water on their driveway. Some pets and horses... It's the hurricane. Yes, it is. Come on in. Does somebody want to assist this person? Okay. I'm going to continue on while we seat Veronica here. Some pets and horses were left behind to fend for themselves, and they subsequently drowned in the storm surge. After a tree fell on his car, a man on Long Island frantically shook a police officer, saying, "That car's brand new. Who can I sue? Who can I sue?" And there was substantial looting. In East Hampton, it was devastated. West Hampton saw 28 dead and 4 missing, 153 of 179 houses destroyed. The Long Island Expressway was blocked off in several places. Bridgehampton, New York, devastated. Of the estimated 2 billion trees that were lost in the Northeast, 3,500 trees were lost in the Bridgehampton, Sagaponack, Hayground area alone. Sadly, these elms and locusts that formed a half-mile-long arch over Main Street had been planted before the American Revolution and can still be seen in the canvases of many important artists. When the storm was over, 42% of the Main Street elms were gone. Nassau, Long Island, knocked down. Dune Deck, Bayside, New York. The ocean-torn inlet between West Hampton Beach and Quogue, 400 feet wide and 20 feet deep. Waves broke on lawns 1 mile inland. 6 miles south of Bayshore, across Great South Bay, Saltaire lost 125 houses. Kismet and Fair Harbor, 91 homes. Oak Beach, 29 houses. And Point of Woods, 15. Fire Island, Long Island, was scoured. Fire Island saw 200 homes that had been perched on dunes 20 feet high. The next day, it was nothing but a sandbar. All the houses were gone. A man by the name of Frederick Foster Durham, 54 years old, vice president of the Fulton Trust Company. The New York train that he was on was marooned in Warwick, Rhode Island. His usual 15-minute trip home took 2 hours. He got home by 8 o'clock. As he washed up for dinner, he dropped dead from exhaustion and exposure. Have you seen my mummy? At Saltaire, the morning after the storm, a young blonde girl sat on a box. As the chief assistant DA, Lindsay Henry, arrived, she asked, "Could you assist us in the search for a body?" "Of course," said the Mr. Henry. "Whose body is it?" She shut her eyes tightly and sadly said, "My mummy's." Heroes. West Hampton Police Chief Stanley Teller, Officer Tim Robinson saved 17 people. Halfway across the West Bay Bridge, they abandoned their two cruisers and waded and swam the rest of the way. They save a helpless woman and her 3 children in deep water on Dune Road. They lead all 17 people onto the roof of a house. A huge wave then swept the house off of its foundation. 3 hours later, all 17 land safely at Quogue, having crossed the bay. Here's a story. I'm going to drive the narrative here. It's called The Flight of the Burghards. Remarkable story. George and Mabel Burghard, their fox terrier Bitsy, and their cocker spaniel Peter, with their caretakers, Carl and Selma Dalen, rented a cottage. The cottage was 75 feet from the top of a 9-foot dune, 100 feet from Dune Road, and 75 feet from the Coast Guard station. The distance to the water's edge was 200 feet. Their neighbors had a 30-foot cabin cruiser moored to the dock between the houses. Chronology here. 10 a.m. The wind is strong from the north. It's overcast. There's some drizzle, and the seas are heavy. 11 a.m. The wind shifts to the east, then to the northeast at gale force. Dalen reports water bubbling through the concrete floor of the garage. They thought it was fresh water from the bay. It wasn't. It was salty. Mabel puts on her swimsuit. Noontime. Neighbor's boat is drifting. Burghard calls Chief Botswain's mate James Ketchum at Mauritius Coast Guard Station. 30 miles to the west of their location. And what's he say? He says, "I'll be right down." 1 o'clock, radio station WESF broadcasts, "The West Indies hurricane is in the mid-Atlantic." No, it's not. It's right on top of Long Island. Electric power at 1 o'clock is still on. 1:30 p.m., friend Bill Ottman calls and says that his garage has just been blown into the bay. 2 o'clock, 90-mile-per-hour wind is now shifting to the east. The water is now 2 feet deep in the Burghard's garage. Mabel is sewing in the sunroom with her back to the bay windows. Mrs. Dalen politely suggests that she should change her seat. Just as she changes her seat, the window blows out with glass shards everywhere. Half hour later, 2:30 p.m., wind and rain is intensifying. Their bathhouse is swept away. 3 o'clock, Burghardt tells Dalen to pack the clothes and move to the third floor. At 3:10, a wave breaks through the back door and sweeps Dalen off of his feet. 3:30 p.m., John Avery, the Coast Guard man, comes across the meadow. Let's get moving quick, everybody. No time to lose. Let's get out. High tide is due at 6:10 p.m. Burghardt stuffs his tennis tickets for the match at Forest Hills the following day into his pocket. 4 o'clock. Mabel Burghardt picks up Peter. George picks up Bitsy. They both have their dogs. The Dalens, who are much older than the Burghardts, are dilly-dallying. The wind is now up over 100 miles per hour. There's a half-mile walk to the bridge across the bay. Mrs. Dalen is being nearly dragged by Avery. Old Carl Dalen clings to the fence post back on the driveway as the group moves down the road. This is heartbreaking. Carl then sits down on the fence, exhausted. Imagine getting blasted with a wind over 100 miles per hour. It can tuck you up pretty good. His head is down. He's now 75 feet beyond the group. He can't hear their call due to the wind. Mrs. Dalen is now hysterical as she turns back and her husband is sitting down now. He's going nowhere. The death knell has been sounded. The wind suddenly shifts to the southeast at 110 miles per hour. 50-foot breakers come roaring over the sand dunes. Flotsam drifts by in the raging sea torrents. There's a boat tied to the dock, and they move toward it. It's 4:15. With a sickening crash, the Coast Guard station hits the bay and smashes to pieces. Just then, the line snaps, and the boat, their only salvation, is dragged out to sea. Now what do we do? Electric wires hit the ocean, electrocution a distinct possibility, in puddled areas only. Mrs. Dalen is now 50 feet behind the main group. She's refusing to move. She's calling to her husband, Carl, who's 125 feet behind. The Burghardts, with a dog each under their arms, go out onto the broken dock, and they lie down, hoping to ride it out like a surfboard. Just then, a large, flat piece of wooden siding comes by, and Mabel, George, the dogs, and Coast Guardman Avery climb onto it. The wind had driven the bay water across to the mainland with such force that for about 200 feet, the bay bottom was completely dry. The Dalens are forsaken and helpless. The Burghardts and Coast Guardman Avery jump off the board and wait for a giant wave that takes them 200 feet out into the bay. There's 6-foot waves that continually wash them off the board, and they climb right back on. They dodge flotsam, cars, jagged glass, and boards with nails moving quickly by them. They place the dogs on trailer little rafts. Bitsy's washed off, but Peter grabs him by the ear and drags him back to the raft. They paddle around huge chunks of houses and debris. Ducks fly by backwards at 40 miles per hour. The raft is grounded in berry bushes. They made it. Except Bitsy disappears in the brush. They land 1 mile west from their house at Onek, across the bay, and they head to higher ground at the golf course. They wave down a car and make their way into West Hampton. Avery, meanwhile, moves off to help more people. Unselfish. Some of their personal belongings, the Burghardt's belongings, are found miles away from their house. Eventually, the Dalen's bodies are located. Carl was found near the golf course where they landed. He was probably carried by the storm surge and had a broken leg. He drowned. John Avery was cited for bravery. Wood is pierced through wood like an arrow. And then the looting begins, so every street corner now has an armed man waiting for looters. There's 48-hour price gouging going on, that selfishness motif. And that awful sea smell stuck around for over a year. Quogue, New York, before and after the gymnasium turns into a mortuary. There's a breach at Shinnecock Inlet. You have a nice peninsula here. What is it, House Neck? That could be breached if a storm hits it properly. From where I come from, Duxbury Beach, that could be breached one day. And that's what happened at Shinnecock Inlet. It just broke right through. We know about the Portland Gale. It changed the course of the North River. When Mother Nature wants to change the course of landscape, she does it. She doesn't ask questions or look for permission. Heroes of Stony Point. Two beavers you're looking at. 60 colonies of beavers from the Adirondacks of 500 beavers built 60 dams. The dam in Palisades Park held back swollen rivers and ponds. The beavers worked all through the night of the hurricane to fortify their bulwarks. Long Mountain Beaver Pond doubled in size from 5 to 10 acres due to the dam made of mud, sticks, stones, and sod. It was 150 yards long and 6 feet high, held fast, only spilling 18 inches of water over its top. Remarkable and uncanny. We'll see some other accounts of how animals seem to know that Mother Nature is about to unleash her wrath. Cedar Hill Pond Dam doubled in size to 8 acres. It was 40 feet wide and water rose 2 feet. These guys, these beavers, the 500 beavers, they saved 5 arterial highways that were used for evacuation during the hurricane. Long Mountain Road, Johnstown Road, U.S. Highway 6, 17, and Route 9 West, the heroes of Stony Point. The southeast coast of Connecticut is slammed. At this point, I just want to make a comment. A chicken farmer, okay, in Long Island, some of his chickens after the hurricane are found in Connecticut, swept across Long Island Sound. And I'm going to tell you about some bugs and some seagulls in Poland. And this is where I want to go to my book here. This is the first time I've done this, so this is it's a treat for me, and I think it's going to be a treat for you. We're going to get on board the Bostonian. Numerous accounts of this train ride, but this is a story of heroism. Conductor by the name of Richards. I'm going to talk about him, and then I'm going to read this story outright. But basically, it was a Bostonian, and I apologize if you can't see this image, but it shows a train derailed outside Stonington, Connecticut. As the storm surged and the water rose, this train was halted because the train was stalled up ahead, and sailboats and boats were slammed into the side of it. Meanwhile, the tracks were being washed out, and this train is packed. It's full of businessmen. It's tracked out, full of high school and college students. And it's 275 passengers are at risk here. And many of the students go into a prep school. So what I want to do now is cut over here and read aloud. The Bostonian by Irwin Ross. It was a day set apart for terror. Out of the south, an eerie wind howled about the rooftops of New London, Connecticut. It whipped the usually placid waters of the Thames River into a white fury. From skies so close they seemed to hug the earth, a slashing, fitful rain beat down. Engineer Harry Easton of the Bostonian Crack Express train of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford line peered anxiously from his cab as the train all but crawled along the South Shore route toward Boston, more than 100 miles away. Easton was not a man to frighten easily, but he had good reason for caution. In the cars behind him, he had 275 passengers. And somewhere ahead of him in this wind-torn chaos between New London and Boston, he had a rendezvous with a hurricane. All week there had been portents of unnatural things to come. The heat was oppressive for September. Day after day, rain fell. Somewhere, deep in the tropics, born in the vast reaches of the South Atlantic, one of the greatest hurricanes of modern times was roaring northward, gathering momentum as it skirted Florida, sweeping across the sea and hurtling past the Carolinas, Virginia, and Delaware. Now, on Wednesday afternoon, September 21st, 1938, Long Island and Connecticut braced for the blow. Slowly, the Bostonian moved past the town of Mystic, half hidden in the savage gray downpour. Powerful gusts of wind rattled the cars. The train shuddered as Engineer Easton throttled down to 7 miles per hour. "Keep that fire going," he shouted to his firemen. With every passing moment, the storm increased in fury. Peering ahead, Easton felt the skin about his temples grow taut. Telegraph poles were beginning to topple. Trees bent almost double and crashed to the earth. But before he could bring his passengers into the comparative safety of the next station, that of Stonington, which was a mile away, he would have to take the Bostonian over a narrow, exposed causeway that stretched 2,000 feet across an expanse of Long Island Sound. His mouth set grimly, his hand firmly on the throttle, he nursed the Bostonian forward. Through the murk, he caught a glimpse of the causeway. Water was already beginning to lap at the ties. The train crept out of the narrow ribbon of track and began inching its way forward at 5 miles per hour. It went only about 100 yards, 200 yards. Now the gale struck with all of its power. 100-mile-an-hour winds roared across the turbulent sound. At that very moment, he saw the signal tower light. It was red. He uttered an oath and jammed on the brakes. The Bostonian ground to a stop. Easton glanced back. What he saw sent a chill up and down his spine. The last three coaches were leaning to one side like a child's train derailed by a careless hand. One powerful gust of wind might blow them over. Easton tugged on the whistle cord. They must hear him at the tower. He must get a green signal. The fireman put down his shovel and shook his head. "That whistle won't carry 10 feet in this wind, sir," he shouted. Easton suddenly eased himself from his seat behind the throttle. "All right," he said. "I'm going out there myself. I gotta get that signal changed." "No, don't try it, sir." The fireman held his arm. "Harry, you won't make it." Easton shook himself free, climbed down from the engine, and began walking. He was up to his ankles in water. The wind was like a solid wall. Head down, bent almost double, pieces of debris swirling about his legs, he forged his way towards the tower. Minutes later, he reached it. Then he cupped his hands and yelled, "Hey! Hey there!" A head appeared at the shattered window. Towerman Harry Thomas looked down with amazement at the battered, water-soaked figure. "Give me a green light," Easton roared. "I got 300 passengers. I can't stay out there all night. We'll be blown away." All right, take it easy," Thomas said. "But there's another train stalled up ahead. I'll do what I can do." Easton turned back. Even as he had been standing there, the water had risen with incredible speed. It was now waist deep as he fought and stumbled his way back towards the train. Halfway there, he lost his footing and fell down. He was being swept away. Frantically, he clutched for support. His fingers closed on the rail. He held on with a death grip, managed to pull himself up, and floundered doggedly forward again. Wreckage bruised him, and time again he slipped and fell, but he finally reached the engine and was helped aboard by the strong arm of his fireman. I'm going to break from the story and tell you what happened then. Another engineer by the name of Richards. They're trying to move everybody out of these tilting cars to the forward cars, okay? They're trying to they move all the women and children into the locomotive itself. Can you imagine? There's no room, and you're talking about probably a 5 by 7 foot area in the locomotive, all the women and children huddled there, and they want to move everyone forward. Well, the train steward, to keep morale up, served dinner. So Richards comes back and he says, "I need everybody to move to the forward car." And the man says, "I'm not going to move until I finish my dinner." Richards goes back, takes a shoe, smashes the glass, takes out the fire axe. "I'm going to ask again, are you going to move to the forward car?" Man says, "Yes, I'm done eating." Moves to the forward car. Goes to the next one, and you've got rabble going on with some students, some prep school students. They're throwing things around. They think this is great. They're kids. And he's trying, "Excuse me, I need your," doesn't get any attention. He smashes the axe through a window. "Now I got your attention. Everybody's going to move to the front car." Wish they did. Back to our story. So weary and battered, Easton climbed into his seat. As he was about to grip the throttle, George Barton, the conductor, hurried into the cab. "The roadbed under the last three cars is washed out." Easton looked back. The cars were now leaning at a 45-degree angle. They might topple into the water at any moment. "Get those passengers into the forward cars," he snapped. "Uncouple those last three. We'll go on without them. Work fast." Another reader's note. At this time, the fireman that said, "You stay here," goes outside the train, water's neck deep. He goes underwater and somehow magically uncouples the second car from the first car so they can free themselves. Bravery. Save their lives. So they're back in the coaches again. Barton orders the terror-stricken passengers into the forward car. The crew works furiously now in water shoulder deep. The engine starts to forge through the high water, drawing behind it a single car jammed with humanity. Everybody's tense. Everybody's alert. One mistake, and it's all over. By now, the raging wind had torn down every telegraph wire. Draped across the engine, caught in front of the smoke box and the pilot, they grew tighter and tighter with every turn of the wheels. Suddenly, there was a series of quick, sharp explosions. Telegraph pole after telegraph pole cracked and toppled over. With wires and poles dragging along on either side, the old Bostonian, like some prehistoric monster, strained to escape from a jungle morass of choking vines and clutching quicksand, and it moved resolutely on. Almost at the end of the causeway, Easton saw looming before him the hulk of a wrecked cabin cruiser. It was directly in his path. He slowed almost to a stop and then drove forward. There was a sound of splintering, and the craft was nudged to one side. A moment later, he saw the top half of a house float majestically into view. Suddenly, it swerved and bore down on the train, coming to rest ahead of the engine. Easton halted a foot from the house. He had no idea how firmly it was wedged in the tracks. If he tried to push it aside as he had the cruiser, the Bostonian might jump the tracks. But he had no choice. The sea was now almost as high as the cab. Easton gripped the throttle and pulled it back slowly. The engine groaned and moved forward, driving its nose into the side of the house. Easton added steam. There was a dull crunch and a crash. Now the engine was laboring. Easton, all but holding his breath, dared to pull the throttle back farther and farther and farther. Suddenly, the house gave way. It slipped one side and careened crazily off toward the distant shore. Minutes later, the Bostonian, one battered engine, one battered coach, and one indomitable engineer in control, chugged triumphantly into Stonington, 275 people saved. I've never read that before, so I just wanted to share that with you. Thank you. Just to close here, Danielson, a 120-year-old steeple toppled over, one of the most famous photographs of the hurricane of 38. One of my favorite stories. Katharine Hepburn. We're in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. What about Kate? Well, she's considered to be box office poison. A film that she was in flopped, and I'll talk about that in a moment. She had just auditioned for a film that was about to commence production. She was excited. And with her friend, her boyfriend, Red Hammond, she went and played some golf. It was a very humid and breezy day. This is September 21st. On the par 3 ninth hole, she scored a hole-in-one. She finished with her best round ever, an incredible 31 on 9 holes. Afterwards, she and Red went for a swim in front of the house. She stated about the breezy weather and rising surf, something very special is going to happen. Well, their family, the Hepburns, had a very elegant summer house that they'd had there since the turn of the 20th century. Her brother Dick was a writer and was working on a screenplay. Kate was waiting to hear if she had got the part of Scarlett O'Hara in, ironically, Gone with the Wind. She had just finished making Bringing Up Baby earlier in the year, which was a bomb. The water rose 17 feet high. Dick and Catherine got the family out as two chimneys crumbled and the guest cottage drifted a half mile away. Family heirlooms, jewels, silverware were lost in the mud. Days later, when Kate got home, she was on her knees, apparently inebriated, digging in vain for her father's and family's jewelry as Red tugged her shoulder gently and said, "Come on, Kate, it's time to leave." Dick found his typewriter and his scripts perfectly intact. Holly would never pick them up, but... Battle of Colts Dyke in Hartford. 1,200 WPA workers, World War I vets, college students, and volunteers fought to keep 1 million tons of water out of the south end of the city that was devastated in 1936. The 1936 flood, I'm not going to talk about it, but it was a huge flood 2 years earlier. Army engineers said there's a 50-50 chance that the bulwark will hold when the water crests at 28 feet. So they're trying to, they decide, do we save the residential area of Hartford or the industrial area? And the decision was made, which I believe is the wise one, save the industrial area. I've seen so many cities destroyed by weather. 1898, Portland Gale, Provincetown. It was the end for all intent and purpose of Provincetown as an important fishing port for the United States. Connecticut River at Hartford, the Traveler's Insurance Tower, I don't know if you can see that, but the clock stopped at 4:10. Mrs. Carl Carlson, driving towards Guilford, Connecticut, was stopped in traffic as they removed a tree from the road. So she decided to pick up a book to read. Just then a tree came crashing down in her car and killed her instantly. The book she was reading was Gone with the Wind. The river, Connecticut River, rose 4 inches per hour. Matt Strong caught a 5-pound bass with his bare hands on Main Street. Frank Fredsall's apple tree was blown over and then later blown upright, and it yielded fruit for a few years afterwards. New London, storm surge, a major fire. I'm not going to talk about that today, but New London was struck by 2 major fires. 1781, the turncoat Benedict Arnold had gone over to the British, burnt it down, and then again, the great New London fire in 1938 that left the sky aglow that you could see for miles and miles. In Cheshire, Connecticut, Patrick Joyce was killed when hurled against a brick wall of a prison building. This was one of the few accounts that I can find of somebody blown by a hurricane and killed in the hurricane of 38. Rhode Island. The plight of the Moore family washed out at Watch Hill. 11 people, including 3 servants, crammed into the attic of a sturdy house on the edge of Little Narragansett Bay. Mr. Moore had suffered a heart attack that morning, but managed to board up the house. Former football player, this is a tough guy. The roof was ripped off and thrown into the sea, and the entire family jumps into an ad hoc raft. Huge waves crash on them. Hammerhead sharks follow the raft. And again, the tropical water being brought up brings the sharks with them. They floated clear across the peninsula in the bay, and they drifted into a cove on Barn Island. So they huddled in an abandoned barn on Barn Island, and they watched the glow of the New London fire overnight. Finally, they were rescued the next day by lobstermen. All 39 houses on Watch Hill were wiped off the face of the earth. It became a sand dune. And a 20-mile stretch from Napatree Point to Point Judith saw 175 dead. There was a women's church group that had just served lunch on the beach. And again, they weren't warned. Napatree, before, Napatree, after. This is people building on the coast, and they're doing that right now. They didn't know about hurricanes. The storm hit westerly at 3:50 p.m., 10 minutes to 4. 100 people were killed in Misquamicut. 194 of 200 houses destroyed. 50 bodies were washed up in the sand dunes. Island Park, Rhode Island, 19 people killed. 198 of 200 houses destroyed. The tidal marsh and backflow of Newport. Conemaugh Beach, Narragansett Bay, 100 homes destroyed. 100 homeless in Oakland Beach near Warwick. Quote, my baby has just been blown out of my arms. Oh, a quick story back to the Bostonian. One of the passengers got out of the Bostonian to try to help the engineer. He saw a doll float by. He picked up the doll. It was a baby. And he saved the baby's life. Jamestown, Rhode Island. 14 people in Barrington die. 86 of 100 boats are destroyed on Block Island. Here are the three quotes you hear most. Where do I go now? What do I do? Everything that I own is gone. And of course, I had no insurance. And the rats at Brown University. I'm not talking about the folks that work in the bursar's office there. The calls began coming in to a couple of local exterminators that day on the 21st, early in the morning, that mice had infested a women's dormitory and that rats were seen at the library at Brown University. Were they seeking higher ground at College Hill? Cats and dogs went missing on the morning of the hurricane. Squirrels and birds were moving about in an agitated manner. Providence. Storm surge struck at 5:15 just as the power went out and people were leaving their offices. A white wall of water rushed up Providence River. A deluge of water 13 feet high in city streets. Very, very high, and it's marked to this very day in Providence. Let me tell you, that was nothing compared to the September gale of 1815, what it did to Providence. Providence River rose 17 feet in 70 minutes. Appliances and consumer goods floated down the streets from department stores. Monhegan was wrecked near Providence. This is what I call wedding splashers. Joe Fogel and Lorraine Martin are scheduled to get married on that fateful day of September 21st, 1938. They're going to get married on the second floor in the ballroom of the Narragansett Hotel in downtown Providence. Where's Joe? Cold feet? No, he's stuck at Union Station with his family. So 500 refugees seek shelter from the storm in that hotel. And what'd they do? They feasted on the wedding banquet and drank up all the champagne. Joe shows up at 11 o'clock that night. And they're married by a romantic candlelight ceremony by an anxious minister who wants to go home. They took a short walk on a very smelly, muddy street. The water receded by 10 p.m. to their honeymoon suite at the Biltmore. This is a very rare statement, and we're wrapping up our talk here this morning. I've studied weather. Now, this is, what, my ninth year of studying historical weather. And you all saw that tremendous videotape of the Indonesian tidal wave coming in, and how ominous, if you could recognize it, that wall of water, what it is. Well, here's an eyewitness to the storm surge on Massachusetts coast. And he says, he's at Horseneck Beach, Buzzards Bay. It's 5 o'clock, and he says, quote, a long black band was approaching. A solid black wall of water looked like an unusually large black roller coming into the shore with its top being blown off so that it did not curl up and break like an ordinary wave. He's seeing the storm surge. There are 30-foot waves at Horseneck Beach. 41 die in Fall River. Ships, boats, barges torn off their moorings and docks. The oil tanker Phoenix spills its cargo, is blown across the river onto lawns. In New Bedford, and this is what I talk about storms killing economies. New Bedford, 9 cotton mills were destroyed. 10,000 employees jobless. The New Bedford economy would never recover from the hurricane of 38. The Acushnet River rose 11 feet. There are 1,500 people homeless in Fairhaven. I didn't even know there were 1,500 people that lived in Fairhaven. The fishing fleets are overdue. There's anxiety on the docks. According to the New Bedford Standard Times, quote, this is beautiful. Women stood with babies in their arms and watched the horizon in the ageless manner of wives whose men ply the sea. Others went from boat to boat asking questions. Everywhere, the answer was a simple negative shake of the head. Westport, gone. New Bedford, slammed. Woods Hole, wiped out. Wareham, devastated. Bourne Bridge, National Guardman, standing on a house in the Cape Cod Canal underneath the just-finished Bourne Bridge, celebrating a family of seven that perished. 25-foot waves at Chilmark in Martha's Vineyard. Menemsha breached. The bridge from Gay Head to Menemsha washed out. East Brookfield, New Bedford, Springfield, East Bridgewater, Mattapoisson, every town in New England has a story about the great hurricane of 1938. Buildings knocked down, windows broken. I just want to tell you another thing is here about the bugs that came. Let me see if I can get this. I talked to you about the chicken that was found across Long Island Sound during the hurricane of 38. And also, there were some bugs that showed up for the first time. Where is that? Well, bugs had never been a problem in Connecticut until after the hurricane of 38. There was a bug infestation on Long Island Sound, and they think that they were blown across. And also, seagulls never showed up on the Connecticut coast as intense as they did. And that's because the oysters were moved in by the storm surge, making them very accessible to seagulls on the flats. So seagulls basically came across from the sounds and just began feeding in Connecticut. Downtown Boston was hit. The State House blocked off. Hatchell at the Esplanade flooded. Lexington Green, where I marched last week, rendered the battlefield itself. Exeter, New Hampshire got hit. Peterborough, New Hampshire flooded out. The Boston Post says 45 killed in wild hurricane. Property damage in the millions. Hundreds hurt by wreckage. Then the Globe says hurricane dead, 250. The Daily News says 322 dead in storm. Daily Record, 390 dead now. Storm deaths amount to 515 in the Boston Herald. The facts of this hurricane, the peak steady winds, the sustained winds were 121 miles per hour. As I mentioned, the peak gust at Blue Hill Observatory, 186 miles per hour. Lowest pressure, 27.94 at Belport, New York. That's on land in New England. We're not talking about it at sea, the measurements that I gave you. Peak storm surge, 17 feet above normal high tide in Rhode Island. Peak wave heights, 50 feet, several locations including Gloucester. Deaths, 700, 600 in New England alone. Homeless, 63,000. There were 20,000 miles of power wire that was knocked down. 8,900 homes and buildings were destroyed. 3,300 boats were lost. 26,000 automobiles were lost. 2 billion trees were destroyed. The cost in 1938 dollars was $6.2 million, which in 1998 was $15 billion. Shirley Ann Gatz was born at 328 at Eastern Long Island Hospital just as the roof blew off and flooded the delivery room. I've had a couple of people that were born on the day of the hurricane, a bit premature due to the low pressure that induced childbirth to a lot of pregnant women. Just some other hurricanes, the Great Atlantic Hurricane of 44, Edna in 54, Carol in 54, Diana in 55, Donna in 60. And finally, when the Cyclops comes, and if you live through this hurricane, you get it. But I'm going to give you, scientific studies have shown that a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread are not your best protection against a major storm. As you know, whenever there's a storm, everybody goes out and buys all the milk and the bread. The poor cows walk around like cowboys. Check the tides and stay away from the beach. When the authorities tell you to leave, you leave. Do not panic in a traffic jam. Shut off your engine to conserve fuel. Know where the high ground is in your town or neighborhood. The winds are going to shift during a hurricane. Don't count on the wind blowing constantly in one direction. This is the hardest part. Very hardest part is carrying clean drinking water. If you can get water, anything that you do during a hurricane, if you can take anything aside from clothes, get a gallon of water. That's what you need. As a human being, You can go without food, but you can't go without water for a sustained period. Stay away from downed power lines and, if possible, water containing downed power lines. Trees and houses can topple in an instant. Don't swim against the current. And if you're within 2 miles of the coast, you're vulnerable to storm surge. And finally, if you be a clown, you will drown. If you go down to watch the storm, you'll get caught in it. This is the 21st hurricane century hurricane blast zone that I projected. I feel that they would go all the way inward, storm surge through the Charles, into inundate East Watertown. That's my prediction with a major hurricane. My resources, A Wind to Shake the World, marvelous book by Everett Allen. Also, R.A. Scotty's Sudden Sea, and Cherie Burns' wonderful Great Hurricane in 1938. I host what's known as the New England History Festival on Saturday, November 14, 2009. I'll be talking about the Martha's Vineyard waterspout of 1896. That's my talk for this morning. You've been a wonderful audience. Thank you. Now, here's where you're educating me. As I mentioned, you're all too young to have been around in 38, but I want to hear your stories, even if you saw leaves blow by. Does anybody want to give me a ditty and tell me what they remember of that day?
Well, we were expecting this couple from Virginia. We were expecting they were bringing this little girl to stay with us. And, of course, we were anxious for them to get there because we were going to have this little girl live with us. They didn't show up, they didn't show up, and they didn't show up. And actually, I was so young myself. I was young once. So
was I, my friend. So was I.
But I remember going out after the storm was over. I fell. I've got scars on my knees.
Wow.
Yeah, fell down. But my mother let us out. But we had to be careful because the trees were down all over the place, and it was exciting.
My dad hates when I tell the story, but I'm going to tell it. He was a young man, and he took his grandfather's best umbrella and decided to play Mary Poppins and jump off the garage roof. Well, the umbrella was broken, and he got what was known as red bottom in those days.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have? Yes, please.
I think I'm in the wrong group.
You're in the wrong group. Wonderful. Okay, thank you. But did you enjoy the talk anyways? It was nice having you. Does anybody else have something? Yes.
I was 5 years old, and I realize now that my mother must have been in a complete panic. The older children in the family were not home. My father was at work. And when it hit in Dorchester, she told us, the little ones, to hold on to the windows. We had like a den, I forget what you might call it, a glassed-in area of the house we were living in at the time. And as I grew up, I thought, golly, that wasn't a very smart thing for my mother to tell us to do, but I realized then how frightened she must have been. Fortunately, none of the windows blew in. Oh.
What do you hear from Frank here? Frank, what do you get going?
Thank you, John. Excellent presentation.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was.
First off, you mentioned briefly of predictions of the storm. One person, nobody would listen. The same thing happened in Yokohama in 1923 when Yokohama and half of Tokyo wiped out.
If only that happened in 43. Go on, I shouldn't have said that, but go on.
I was down in, my family is Little Compton, Rhode Island, and tidal wave wiped out. But a mile away, you can see the ocean, no damage. There's cottages on the pilings, still there today. And in Fall River, we had rain, yes, and we didn't know about it until the next morning. My sister and I, went down to get on a trolley car to go to school. There's no power, no trolley cars. We looked down the river, and there's the Shell oil tanker, Phoenix, driven across the water, halfway into the highways, one lane cut off. Utter devastation. The boats all over the place, but it was a big
Anything, Fred, that you can think of? This is Fred Shaw, folks. And he's done extensive research on historical weather as well. We had a nice conversation prior to my talk.
What stood in your mind outside? Did you recognize that as a child, that this is bad, this is serious, or was there more wonder and amazement than terror for you? Do you remember what emotion?
No, it was just another day.
Just another tricky day.
We had rain. We had branches come down before. Nothing to it until we got down to the sea, out of devastation. Mm. We got down to the beach family there, and the tidal wave came in. Other sections not even touched.
Wow.
The farmhouse, the farmers lost their corn, was laying down. But
amazing, because of the 2 billion trees that I mentioned in 1941, April 21st, 1941, something known as the Great Brant Rock Fire took place. But also across Massachusetts, 200 fires raged out of control. National Guard was called out, and for all intent and purpose, martial law for that day. Because it was so dry. Does anybody else have a comment about the hurricane of 1938 before we close? Yes.
I remember being driven from Boston, and before we got in the car, it was very windy. We had flared skirts, and the wind was blowing them up, and we were holding them down. But a billboard flew across in front of us, and the woman who was driving said, "If I were in Florida, I would think we were having a hurricane." Wow. We lost two trees in front at the front entrance to our home, and they went across Washington Street, blocking traffic. And they weren't, you know, nobody was prepared for cutting them down. I don't know how long the traffic was tied up.
And we've never seen a storm with that intensity since. I mentioned Hurricane Bob. That was a hiccup. That wasn't even... There was a tropical depression. And did you see the devastation that did to Wareham?
Look like Hurricane Carol was pretty bad.
Okay, Carol.
I had personal experience myself. My folks had a place when Hurricane Carol struck down at the Maritime Academy.
54.
And you mentioned about the house on the Cape Cod Canal went in. Mm-hmm. There was 13 houses that went in down there at Taylor's Point, okay, is where the Maritime Academy is, went into the Cape Cod Canal, went down the Cape Cod Canal. They had 6 feet of water in there. And so forth. That cottage got lifted up and went to another neighbor's yard and held on. But the devastation down there was damaged. That was in 1954.
Yeah, I don't know much about anything about Carol, Edna, or Donna.
Swift Beach got wiped out, which is part of Wareham and so forth. And maybe
Swift got wiped out in Hurricane Bob.
And I think Cross Neck Beach got wiped out again, too. So it's kind of like history does repeat itself.
You're right. And there are exposed areas that will continually be pounded. Yeah. Does anybody else have any comments before we close for the morning? Yes, sir.
Two or three little picky questions.
Sure.
At the time of the tsunami, was it 3 or 4 years ago?
Yes,
didn't some people say animals were agitated?
A lot of folklore there, yes. And there was one that goes on the internet. And, you know, the internet has a lot of promises. Some it delivers on, but most of it does not.
I was wondering if that happened in 38.
Well, the little anecdotal evidence that I had about the rats and the mice up on College Hill, they went to the higher ground. About pets going missing. There is a man by the name of Berglund who studies earthquakes in California who says that when pets go missing a week, he'll predict if he sees them a lot that there's an earthquake coming. So it depends. Fish do react differently. You don't find a lot of dead animals, strangely, after storms, which would infer that they've gone to safety. So, they know where to go, right, which is out of here. So it depends. I wouldn't believe anything that comes out of from the Indonesian government. I have to tell you that personally anyway. So.
And do you have this wind speed that was at Mount Washington? Was it roughly the same as Great Blue Hill?
I would say no. Not in my records could I, during the storm you're talking about. Nothing comparative. And I'm going to say that was a little to the north and east of where the track was, so it probably got some gusts, but nowhere near the 180 plus miles per hour at Blue Hill. Yeah, exactly. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah. What are all the improvements in communication that could warn people, if they pay attention, about these things coming?
Well, the problem is there's too many.
Yeah.
I've Hurricane Bob, I was with my girlfriend, and I didn't have the news on for 2 days until I got home. My roommate said, "We've got a hurricane." I said, "What are you talking about? It's a hurricane about to hit us." I wasn't paying attention. So I guess it's listening to WBZ, you know, or listening to your forecaster and listening to the news and getting the information that way and listening to what they say, too. That's the key. They know better than we do. Yeah, pay attention.
Yeah.
We had a nice apple orchard, and we lost, I don't know, most of the trees.
Yep.
Apple orchard.
Yeah, a lot of orchards did go down. And they, as I mentioned, they became kindling wood for a great fire in 1941. Have to go. Thank you very much, Hingham Low Vision Group. God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you.